It's my pleasure to introduce you to our speaker tonight. It says here that I can pick and choose the biographical information, but I love it all, so I'm going to give it all to you. Our speaker tonight is W. Grant McMurray. He was born in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and his family moved to the U.S. when he was a young teen. He served most of his life as a denominational executive in the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which was renamed the Community of Christ during his tenure as the faith's prophet president between 1996 and 2004. Now semi-retired, he is involved in public policy from a peace and justice perspective and is trying to coax the great American novel from out of his soul and onto paper. He is married, has two sons, and lives in Independence, Missouri. So that's that. That's the official program blurb. The rest of it is from his blog, and I can't tell you how delightful it is that he has a blog. Don't you wish President Hinckley had a blog? Anyhow, we can hope, right? From his blog, My Home. Born at a very young age in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Family moved to U.S. When I was a young teen. Live in historic Independence, Missouri, home and final resting place of plainspoken President Harry S. Truman. The town is also the point of origin for the Santa Fe, California, and Oregon trails. Hence, this is a good place to ponder new frontiers. My heart. Still learning and reflecting at midlife, exploring with others how to embrace heritage, value diversity, pursue peace. Again, trying to coax the great American novel from out of my soul and onto paper. Blogging primarily for my own enrichment and in hopes of discovering fresh ideas and shared commitments to justice. My career. Served most of my life as a denominational executive, now semi-retired and dabbling in public policy from a peace and justice perspective. Traveled widely abroad and worked with groups large and small, young and old. Enjoy using stories and humor to teach simple rules affirming the worth of all persons in a global community. My family, married to a richly gifted and mercifully tolerant woman, blessed by two accomplished and creative adult sons and a wonderful daughter-in-law, live in a household supervised by two cats, insufficiently grateful for their liberation from the animal shelter, but each of whom undoubtedly experienced their own dark night of the soul. Hence, we seem to understand each other. Let's have a welcoming round of applause for Grant McMurray.
Well, you kind of hate it when those things start coming back at you. They're supposed to not be found. I haven't added to that blog for several months, and I am promising to get at it again. But if President Hinckley would like to join in, I'm open. I am delighted to be here and to be able to share with you at the Sunstone Symposium. I have, for a number of years, thought I would very much like to be a part of that, like to go, and I've just never arranged it, and here we are. So I've appreciated very much the invitation and the opportunity to share with you. I really pondered quite a bit about how to get at what I wanted to get at. I thought I was going to be really clever and drop in Mitt Romney's name in the title of my address. And then I later saw the 45-page symposium program, and I realized that Mitt Romney was going to be quite present during the course of this. So I can assure you that while I dropped it in there, I'm really not going to spend very much time on Mitt Romney, except to use him as a reason for some of the explorations that I would like to do. By the way, did you hear that John Stewart said he's the only presidential candidate ever named after a glove? I think what all of us recognize is that the presence of a high-profile Latter-day Saint on the American political agenda will provide a real opportunity to talk about what the Restoration tradition, the Restoration movement, Mormonism in particular, is all about. And there's already been a whole lot of stuff done along that line. Mitt Romney has tried to respond to lots of questions, and I think he's been doing a fairly good job of that. He seems to be willing to let the questions come. He affirms his faith without any defensiveness and seems willing to engage in the kinds of questions that are there. What I would like to do tonight, if you'll just cut me some slack and allow me to explore and kind of wander around a little bit in some thoughts, is to suggest that maybe we have an opportunity here to explore some understandings of the larger Restoration tradition in ways that I don't think are being talked about in the public media, in ways that I don't think even Mitt Romney is talking about, and probably would not particularly agree. But that's all right. If you'll let me just kind of explore a little bit, I'd like to reflect, both from out of my own personal experience, from out of my experience with the community of Christ, and participation with the larger Restoration tradition over the years of Mormon History Association meetings and conferences. I have built over the years a number of very close and important friendships among many of you and others that I've shared with over time. So I want to begin by telling you, and I don't know if this is happening nationally, but in the market that I live, the Mormon Church is doing a lot of television and radio advertising. Is that going on all over the country? Well, I'll bet you that nobody consulted with Mitt Romney about that advertising, and that there are two things that are going on in the advertising that is occurring. One has a family talking about issues, and the end of that discussion is that there is, if you go to Mormon.org, I believe it is, there all truth will be revealed. Now, I grew up in a Latter-day Saint family. My children are fifth generation Latter-day Saints, and I've got a granddaughter on the way sometime around mid-December. And so we are deeply rooted in the larger Restoration tradition as part of the Reorganized Church. My great-grandfather was one of the first persons baptized into the RLDS faith in the late part of the 19th century up on the Manitoulin Island in Ontario. And so that tradition has been there. The idea of possessing all truth, of having a fullness of the gospel understood, and this language was part of my growing up tradition. I remember being a kid and sitting in front of the bookcase in my house and looking at the books by some of our ministers who were well known, and wondering in my mind, how is it that this little white church on Mitchell Avenue in Guelph, Ontario, with just a relative handful of members, could be the possessor of all truth. After all, whenever I have to go to the elementary school and sign up for classes at the end of one of the places they have is a little box where you put in what your religion is. Well, Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints doesn't fit into any of those boxes. And so you have an experience of kind of an identity problem that I do want to talk a little bit about. And so I have struggled with that question myself over the years. What does it mean to claim that we have, in whatever expression of the church it may be, the fullness of the gospel, or are the possessors of all truth? That ad that is appearing in the Kansas City market, I think, does not help identify with the larger community that are watching very closely to see what Mormonism is all about. The other one in Kansas City has to do with the notion of the eternal existence of family and marriage. I have to chuckle because just yesterday we participated in Independence in a memorial service for a gentleman who had been a graphic artist for the church. And he passed away at age 80 or so. And he was had a tremendous sense of humor. He used to do all kinds of cartoons. Now, I know the Mormons have your little books of cartoons. We had a collection of these cartoons about our life together as a people and about church history. But Jack was a very interesting and complex kind of a guy. And one day, he came into my office, and I shared this little vignette in the memorial service, thinking that it would be okay since people knew the way in which he and his wife used to kind of have a repartee that went back and forth between them. But he came into my office on a Monday morning. His wife had been sick for quite some time in a long-term illness, and she was at times fairly difficult. Her illness was difficult to manage. Sometimes her attitude and way of approaching things was a little difficult. And Jack came in and plunked down in the chair by my desk and said, "Oh, man, I had the worst weekend. Faye was just impossible. She complained about everything. She wouldn't do any of the things that she was supposed to do. She was, oh, man, it was terrible." So he said, Sunday morning, I had to stay at home, and so I turned on the TV, and I was flipping through the channels, and a Mormon conference was on there. So I thought, well, I'm going to listen to that. And it was one of the Mormon apostles, and that apostle was preaching about the blessing that Mormons have in knowing that marriage is not just for time, but for all eternity. He said, "I did not need that ministry." So people want to know, what is the Latter-day Saint movement all about? And if you don't mind, I'd kind of like to talk a bit more in those kind of terms, because I recognize full well that the Mormon Church is by far the largest and fullest expression of the Mormon tradition. But there are, as you know, many, many other expressions of it, most of them quite small, some of them fairly vibrant and active. And I think my church, while much smaller, does represent a part of that. And we do have a larger tradition that is part of what it is that people will be interested in. And so the question that I began to ponder is not just what is the tradition of Mormonism as it's been expressed about. When you get to a guy like Romney on the national stage, what is it that people would like to know about this faith tradition? And I have some thoughts about that I think go to places where perhaps we've not talked about before. Maybe not. I want to talk for a moment in a little personal way about the notion of identity. What is it that defines me? What is it that defines you? How is your life shaped and identified in a certain way? And over the time that I worked with the RLDS Church, now known as the Community of Christ, I really believe that question of identity was a huge issue for our movement. You can go back into the 19th century and you see all kinds of evidence of that sort of an issue. And so I've spent a lot of time pondering that, both for myself and personally and for the movement with which so much of my life was identified. I think all of you know, and would understand the way in which this tradition of which we're a part has a way of investing itself in the totality of your life. It's not just a piece of your life. It's not just a Sunday morning experience. Within the Latter-day Saint tradition, those who are active members in that tradition understand that it is something that lays claim to the totality of your life. You are defined through that whole experience. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is worth noting. As you know, I left my responsibilities after 8.5 years of service in the role of president of the Community of Christ and went through a process of really trying to identify, who am I when I am not that? When I am not in that role, who am I? Because over time, and my wife has pointed this out to me on numerous occasions, sometimes it became very difficult to know where the church began and you ended, where you began and the church ended. Those things weren't very clear to her, and frankly, probably there wasn't a place where that could occur. And so I've been thinking about that for a lot of the last several months, now almost 3 years since I left that role, and have tried to think about what that identity really is about. Maybe just a little personal first, and then talk a little bit institutionally, and then to kind of try to draw together a few thoughts about this. As I mentioned, my kids are fifth generation members of the church. They have an appreciation of the heritage that is theirs. Although I have to tell you, and I'll just tell you a quick little story about my son Brian, who is now a communications consultant or artistic director for a communications firm. But when he was a young boy, I happened to have occasion to take him with me for a weekend of activities at Nauvoo. And we stayed most of the time down at the church's campgrounds, which aren't too far away from the historic properties. But on Sunday, when those activities were over, I thought this would be a good opportunity for me to take Brian up to the historic properties and give him what I hoped would be mercifully short, and I wanted him not to be over explained too much detail, because he just was at an age where a little bit would be fine but too much would be not helpful. And so I kind of suggested that to the tour guide privately. I'd like him to see the major buildings. Could we make it fairly quick, and so that he doesn't get overcome with too much Nauvoo information? So we went around and we were doing fine. We got to the mansion house, and at the door of the mansion house, one of the guides, I think a number of them do this, opened the door and turned and said to him, "You know, I just want you to think about this step that takes you into the mansion house. This step is original to this building. That means that the prophet Joseph Smith Jr. placed his foot on this step. And that in the reorganized church, President Joseph Smith III placed his step or his foot on that step. As did Frederick Madison Smith and Israel A. Smith and W. Wallace Smith and Wallace B. Smith. All of those, as well as many other notable people in our church's tradition, have placed their foot on that step. And so for me, it's kind of a neat thing to think about as we go into the building." And she said, "When you put your foot on that step, you will be joining with all of those who went before." And my son Brian looked at that step, looked at that tour guide, and proceeded to jump over the step and walk into the building. So that, you see, is what we have to deal with. And believe me, there are plenty more stories where that one came from that you'll not be submitted to today. But as I think about my own personal life story, I realize the way in which it has knitted me together with so many people and with relationships and places that have been such a part of my life. And part of that identity struggle comes from kind of knowing that you're in a special relationship, and that this little small church that I'm talking about is the place where people who are we are close to, and we have a kind of special connection and relationship to each other. I have an alcoholic father who was gone from my family most of my life. And the way in which the community participated in bringing us together was a very important thing. And I thought about all of that when I was called into responsibilities for the church. I thought about the people in those little congregations in southern Ontario and in Independence and in other places where I had been who had contributed to my life in important ways. In fact, I used a little kind of metaphor for that. When I was ordained to be president of the church in the course of that week, as I shared with the conference on several different occasions, one of the things I told them was the story about being in a Christmas nativity scene in the basement of the Guelph, Ontario church when I was just a young boy. And for some reason, as I stood before the conference chamber of almost 6,000 people, as I was contemplating the experiences that I had had that brought me to that point and the challenges and responsibilities that lay ahead of me, I was thinking very clearly in my mind about that nativity scene, about being a boy in that basement of that church and being somehow invited to participate in something that was important. I told the conference that I was a shepherd, and I remembered being a shepherd in that nativity scene, and that it gave me a sense of connection with my youth and with the people who had influenced my life in so many ways. In the weeks and months that followed, I found more and more people who would say to me, "Boy, it really touched me when you remembered that nativity scene we were in together." And over a period of some months, it began to I began to think about the fact that, my goodness, if all of these people were in that nativity scene, it's going to be one of those grand movies with a cast of thousands. And quite a number of people actually said that they remember being there with me. And then one day, I was standing in a reception line at an activity up in southern Ontario, shaking people's hands, and along came a lady that I knew very well from when I was a young child, and she handed me an 8x10 envelope, brown envelope. I opened it up, and I pulled out a grainy black and white photograph of the very nativity scene of which I had spoken. It was not quite what it had grown in my mind to be. It was like four kids in bathrobes with a soapbox. And it made me realize that the sense of connection that we began to have with people obviously remembering wrongly about being in that particular scene, it wasn't the experience of the scene. It was the connection to community that was so important to all of us, to me in particular. And so I think the issue of identity for all of us is extremely important as we ponder what it is that our movements do in the world and the way in which this experience affects our life going forward. I traveled one time with my family to the Manitoulin Island in Ontario, a place that I'd heard about all my life but had never been. It is a place that I knew had shaped my life because it was there that my great-grandfather was baptized into the movement, because it was there that my grandmother was born and had many stories to tell as I was growing up, and yet for a variety of reasons, I had never actually been to that place. I went there finally as an adult with my family, my two children, and we moved around that island in search of the house where I knew my family had lived. I had instructions. I had some photographs. I had some directions from local people to find it. And I finally worked my way kind of through until I was able to push aside a branch on a tree and look onto this piece of land. And here was this broken down, long ago vacated house that had been the place where my family had birthed the tradition of the Latter-day Saint movement into my life. We went inside. I walked around the building, which had not been occupied for many years, found old pieces of church literature laying there in various places, gathered some of those things up, had a sense of place, of feeling connected to that place in very important ways. I went outside and I walked around the house and I found three smooth stones. I picked them up, put them in the trunk of my car, took them home, and they rest to this day in the little flower garden just outside my house, where I walk past them every day and remind myself of the place from which I came. It was that sense of being connected, not just to a community that is in the present, but to one that reaches back over time. My life has been irrevocably changed because of those experiences of connectedness. I'd like to share with you just fairly briefly some reflections on how that then moves to the experience of the church that claimed my life, the community of Christ, and to share with you a little bit of that journey so that you will understand something of the place from which I have come. Somebody wrote one time that the experience of the community of Christ in the 19th century was one of anomie, A-N-O-M-I-E, which means an uncertain sense of self. And that was surely true. For many, many years, the church, now known as the community of Christ, identified itself not by who it was, but by who it wasn't. I've often said to people that the real name of the church during that time was the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We're not the Mormons. And not being Mormon became a very important part of our identity as we grew up as young people and then on into adulthood. And I cannot imagine fully the impact that that continuing attitude had upon a whole several generations of church members. We were constantly defining ourselves over against another movement instead of allowing an identity unique to ourselves to emerge. The church had been on a profound journey. I just want to give you a snapshot of it. From the time in about 1960, when, and I have a picture in my mind of President W. Wallace Smith on the tarmac of the Kansas City airport, beginning to depart on an around-the-world trip that began the work of opening the church's mission in several other nations of the world. That particular trip is sort of symbolic for me of the larger thing that happened, and that was that the church that had constantly talked about itself as having all truth, as embracing the fullness of the gospel, suddenly found the simple answers that we had given to so many questions to be irrelevant and unconnected to the real source of those questions, because they were coming from out of cultures different than our own. Suddenly the issue was, who are you really? Don't tell me who you are in comparison to Lutherans or Catholics or Methodists, and certainly not in comparison to Mormons, say those who live, for example, in Japan, where approximately 4% of the population of that land was even nominally Christian of any variety. And so you were dealing with Buddhist and Shinto cultures. And to those cultures, you had to answer the question, what are you about really? And that issue pushed the church into an engagement with its faith, with its history, with its theology that it had never known before. And it pushed the leaders of the church in those times. And I consider them, for me, some of the great heroes of my life, because I certainly wasn't in leadership responsibilities at that time. But they chose to confront those questions that caused us then to look back at who we had assumed ourselves to be and to begin to realize that perhaps there was a new way of understanding what our movement was all about. And we went through a long period of difficult times, facing difficult questions, exploring what it means to be the church in those cultures. And to me, the sort of the preeminent expression of that struggle happened in the early 1970s, when we came to grips with the question of how to deal with a topic that has been such a part of our identity and of yours. When the reorganized church split away after the assassination of Joseph Smith, there were two issues that were the primary issues of separation. The first was disagreement over the doctrine of polygamy, and the second was disagreement over the method of presidential succession. Polygamy was a defining issue in the 19th century for the community of Christ. That was one thing on which the church's very identity stood for many, many years. Now here we were in the 1960s in the Sora tribes of India, many of them polygamous cultures, polygamous tribes. And we meet those folks on their own land, bearing their own traditions, and they want to become identified with the church through baptism. But they are polygamist. What is it that we do when faced with that foundational question? I mean, if there's anything we knew about our identity, that surely was it. And that's the one that we had to face right from the get-go. And so the church went through a process of dealing with that question in a most interesting way and finally decided that we were prepared to move forward to begin baptisms of people from those cultures, understanding that they were still polygamous at that point in their life. And the agreement had to be that there would not be additional spouses taken, that the doctrine and principle of monogamy would be taught, but that we were willing to be accepting of the conditions in the culture at the time that we were there. You cannot imagine the struggle. There was a kind of an independent organization's newspaper tabloid type thing as the conference convened that very year, and it was presenting this as a dark cloud hanging over the conference of the church. And the church worked its way through those years. They were tough years. There was a lot of conflict and contention in the conference meetings. I remember very well a fine scholar, Mormon scholar, by the name of Bob Matthews. Some of you I know remember Bob. He worked on the Joseph Smith's new translation of the Bible, published a book on that. So he spent, because we have the manuscript of that in our archives, Bob spent a lot of time in Independence at the archives. And I remember one year he showed up to do research on the very week our World Conference was in session. And so our procedure at that time was that when the business sessions were taking place, all of the offices were closed and the staff would go into the business sessions and watch the way in which the legislation was moving through. I don't think that's done anymore, but at that time in the 1970s, it was. This was a pretty wild time, and people got into pretty noisy discussions about the way in which some of these decisions were being made. And Brother Matthews was a kind, sweet, spirited man, and he went in to watch the legislative sessions. And I remember very well after one, he came out and he came back towards the library, and I was there unlocking the library. I was working in the history department of the church at that time. And he came, and I said to him, "Well, Bob, what did you think of the conference?" And I could tell that his eyes were kind of rolling back into the back of his head and twirling, kind of like my kids are able to do. "Well, it was pretty interesting," he said. "I just don't know how you can talk to your president that way." And I said, "Well, you know, that's just kind of the way we do things." Boy, did I change my mind on that one a few years later. One time, Leonard Arrington, the late church historian of the LDS Church, much beloved by many of us, came also to one of those conferences. I don't know what was going on, why there was such an interest in being there during that time, but I remember Leonard said to me one time, "You know, I once voted to sustain your president." I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "Well," he says, "I was there visiting the conference," and he said, "I guess you've got groups where you have certain priesthood offices," and they had, in those days, had ex officio status for all high priests, and so there was a section of the conference that was laid out for high priests to sit in. And then there were these ushers whose job it was to keep people out of there, well, that shouldn't be there. So Leonard approached him, and one of these guys said, "Hey, are you in the priesthood? Are you a high priest?" Leonard said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Sit down over there." And he said, then he realized that they were bringing up the vote to sustain the president of the church. Well, I wasn't going to vote no in that crowd, so... Dealing with international expansion, dealing with new ways of understanding Scripture, dealing with the question of whether women have ministerial opportunities and responsibilities, of course, that was the biggest, most complicated, and probably the issue that had more consequence to the church because of those who simply could not accept the way in which that call of women to the priesthood. And the church has continued to suffer from some of the issues related to that. And then this building is built, the temple, and it becomes a symbol of an emerging new understanding that the church has begun to build and develop, and that I think will be the way in which that will happen in the years ahead. That symbol that calls the church to become dedicated to the pursuit of peace. I think we were unable to fully understand what a powerful metaphor that would be for the church. It drew the community of Christ into looking at its own identity in new and fresh ways. And today, that struggle of understanding what does it mean to build that kind of a building and dedicate it to peace. What does that mean for the people who occupy that building? What does it mean for the community of Christ to be so dedicated? And I never did know when the building went up that part of the responsibility that I would have to assume during my years of service would be trying to help us work together as a people, not to building the building, but to deciding how shall we occupy that building as a people dedicated to peace. What does it mean for this particular movement to be that kind of a movement? And then, because of my departure from the leadership of the church, I've now had some time to do some further reflection, not just on who am I now that I'm not that, but also, what is it that I would want to distill from out of the totality of my church experience, 33 years of service in a variety of different capacities, working in history, in administration, and then in trying to be a part of the visionary effort to lead the church into its future, whatever that future may be. And I have thought a great deal over these last few years in a new position now to be not carrying leadership responsibilities, but to still have that commitment and love for the church, and yet wanting to know if there's something about that journey that would speak personally to me in new ways. In fact, what I went through was to try to distill the essence of what is it of all of the things that we did together, what is it that speaks to me still, whether religiously, spiritually, or in perhaps more secular ways. And I have identified some things that work for me. And as I've thought about those things and wondered how is it that we present to the larger community of churches and people of faith, and now driven in part by the Romney, the focus on Romney as a asking the question, what is it that you Mormons really believe? What is it about some of these things that may perhaps provide a different platform for us to walk on? And here is what I came down to. I read it to you in one sentence. This is just sort of what I decided for me after a lot of thinking and reflecting, spoke to the essence of my own faith tradition, every piece of it rooted in the restoration tradition. I say that in this way. I seek to build community by embracing heritage, valuing diversity, and pursuing peace. I seek to build community by embracing heritage, valuing diversity, and pursuing peace. As I've thought about the Latter-day Saint tradition, there is nothing more significant in the Latter-day Saint tradition than the call to build community. Latter-day Saints were part of that communitarian spirit of the early 19th century when Emerson said there was nary a man walking around but had the plan for a perfect community tucked away in his vest pocket. And we know that that was part of that communitarian experiment, was such an important part of the 19th century experience. But the Restoration tradition had a unique look at that. And so the valuing of community, and when I looked at what happened with our name change for the reorganized church, when we went through a whole lot of thinking and reflecting, and finally came up with the community of Christ as the two underpinnings of our movement, belief in Jesus Christ and a commitment to the building of community. Those were the two things that we felt were most important. A lot of people thought we changed the name of the church because we no longer wanted to be identified as we were with the Mormons. That really had nothing to do with it. It was because our sense of mission called us to try to pick up and to focus on it. Now, a lot of our people said it was helpful because the confusion over the name was no longer there. But I remember one person came to me and said, before we officially made the change, said, well, I wanted to try out the new name. And so I was talking to a lady, and she said to me, what church do you belong to? And so I said to her, I belong to the community of Christ. And the woman furrowed her brow, and she said, what is that, some kind of Mormon group? So you can run, but you cannot hide. But I want to just have you think about that one sentence. Community, in my view, there is in the political and secular world as well as the spiritual world, nothing more important to us today in our world than finding community. Community that connects people together instead of partitioning them off from one another. Community that builds bridges instead of breaks down bridges of connection. It is so important that we begin to see the many ways in which community is a significant part of our world and speak so powerfully to our time. And the connection of heritage, I use the word embracing heritage because sometimes heritage does not seem always to be a good thing. Sometimes that's true in our personal lives, sometimes that's true in our communal lives. But what I want to say is that heritage is what we come to understand about our past, and it has to be embraced, the good and the ill, because that defines who and what we are. Embracing and really understanding our heritage is so important to us. The valuing of diversity, not simply saying, isn't it wonderful that there are so many different kinds of people in the world, but really to understand diversity is not something just to be accepted, but to be valued, because it makes a difference that we understand that we're all so different in so many ways. And then, of course, pursuing peace, an active way of approaching that question. Well, I've thought about that from the standpoint of Mitt Romney, and I've done him a wonderful service here. I've written in four paragraphs what I think Mitt Romney could say about the underpinnings of his faith in a way that speaks to what it is that the Latter-day Saint tradition has to offer to the secular world, to the making of public policy. So much of the questions that go to people of faith have to do with how will that faith affect the way in which you govern, the way in which you legislate, the way in which you function as a political leader. So let me offer Brother Romney, in the spirit of our shared relationship as part of the Restoration tradition, let me offer this as just a starting point. I suggest that Mitt Romney would say something like this: I bring to this presidential campaign a religious heritage that for my family goes back many generations. Mormons are part of a movement that is the largest religious tradition birthed on American soil. And of course, if he wanted to, he could go on and mention the Community of Christ, especially for all the help we've given him on his speeches. My church has a variety of sacramental expressions that witness to our belief in Jesus Christ and our understanding of eternal life. But what this country needs to know about me is that my religious tradition has provided me with core values that will frame the way I function in my office and that inform the approach I will take to matters of public policy. At the heart of my faith is a commitment to community, perhaps the single most important need in the world today. I find community rooted in a respect for heritage, so that we know from whence we have come. A recognition that every person has infinitesimal worth in God's eyes. A concept that will fundamentally change the way we govern and the way we treat each other. And in the pursuit of peace, which compels us to talk about bridges of understanding rather than weapons of destruction. Call me a dreamer, but I accept the label because my faith began here in America with a dream that is worthy not just of this land, but all of God's creation. I do not expect to vote for Mitt Romney, not at all because he's a Mormon, but because I have seen no evidence that his political views represent what I believe to be the essence of the religious tradition we share. My experience with the Community of Christ makes me believe that our heritage, like us, can be reborn, can be made new. It is important for us to talk about being dreamers. So often, those who would govern have lost the ability to dream, to hold before ourselves an image of what we would want to be, to hold before ourselves a challenge that says we have to reach for those things that seem beyond our grasp. We have to accept that even if we fall short, it is in the act of dreaming, it is in the act of reaching that great things can happen. It is so important for us to understand that some of those principles, the worth of persons in the sight of God, if you embrace that Latter-day Saint concept, then you change the way in which the political discourse goes forward. If every person is of inestimable worth in the sight of God, then the way in which your public policy questions are addressed is changed fundamentally and overnight, and it is rooted in the restoration tradition. If you believe in the power of the past to both heal and redeem, it is rooted in this tradition to find great value in those who went before us, to understand the journey that they were on, and to realize that we are but fellow sojourners along the same journey. Graceland used to have a wonderful little poster that they used to promote the college, and it said on it, "We do not seek to walk in the paths of those who went before. We seek the things they sought." It is that sense of connection to the past and to rediscover it over and over again, to redeem it and make it new, that is so important for us. And finally, to put at the heart of what it is that we do a commitment to peace. To say, as many of us have been called to say in various ways throughout the scriptures of the church and in the traditions of the Latter-day Saint movement, to look into the mirror and say each day, what am I going to do toward the cause of peace? I believe those tremendous principles are rooted in the restoration tradition. It's time for us to dream those dreams, to distill from our past and our present experience those things that allow us to speak about them, not just in our sanctuaries, not just in our churches, but in the many places where we go, and certainly in the places of government where matters of public policy, if decided on those issues of which we have spoken that are part of our tradition, would transform our very nation. We are deep into our movement's second century. It is time for us to let it speak once again, to give it room to breathe, to reshape and to inform our lives with new understandings that transform us, inspire us, embolden us, and fill us not just with hope, but also joy. Alas, I'm not sure that Mitt is going to do it. Perhaps that leaves you and me.
Thank you for those very insightful and thought-provoking and hopefully some action-provoking remarks this evening. One thing I'd like to say, I neglected to mention this at the beginning, but we are bidding goodbye to two of our longtime stalwart board members this year who are stepping down. Jeff Burton and Earl Wunderly have given us many years of dedicated service, and would like to thank them and wish them well on their future pursuits. Uh, As always, we will close with a song, and I understand from Dan that that Grant, you have a story about the song that we're going to sing, "Redeemer of Israel." Would you like to come up and share that with us before we begin? After the song, our closing prayer will be given by Francis Menlove.
Sometimes the truth is not as easy to capture as we know, so I will tell you the story, although it's denied by some of the participants or principals. Back in the 1960s, I believe it was, late 60s, meeting of the Mormon History Association, Dick Howard, who was long the church historian of the Community of Christ, now historian emeritus, was leading a session on restoration hymnody. And so he had dug out a lot of the old songs from the early days and then some of the old familiar ones that we enjoy. And so came time to sing Redeemer of Israel. And to this day, Dick Howard denies that this was intentional. But Leonard Arrington, who was kind of his partner in crime, refused to his dying day to accept that explanation. I do too. I know Dick way too well. But whether intentional or not, was enormous fun. We sang the first two verses, and then he said to the audience, who was quite a few Community of Christ people there, our LDS church then, he says, "Okay, want to have the RL or the Mormons sing the third verse and the RLDS people to sing the fourth verse of this song." And so as you get along here, you know, we have the first couple of verses, and then we get into the third verse, and the Mormons began to sing, "How long we have wandered as strangers in sin and cried in the desert for thee. Our foes have rejoiced when our sorrows they've seen, but Israel will shortly be free." And then, of course, it was followed by the reorganized church people saying, "As children of Zion, good tidings for us. The tokens already appear. Fear not and be just, for the kingdom is ours. The hour of redemption is near." So I understand that Dick has agreed to try to recreate that experience at some forthcoming gathering, this time admitting to the intentionality of it all, but I think it may be only because he thinks if he's going to be blamed for it, he wants to be guilty.